For the past 3 years, the Science of Reading Star Awards have honored educators who are beacons of light, guiding their classrooms, schools, districts, and most importantly, students through transformations with literacy. Now join us as we honor this year's winners at a special celebration event, which will feature celebrity keynoters and past podcast guests. Mitchell Brookins.
2 years ago, one of my students as a school administrator came to me on the playground and he said, "Mr. Brookins, I want to be like the other kids." And I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Mr. Brookins, I want to learn how to read."
And Malcolm Mitchell.
When I scored a touchdown, they either probably put my name in a newspaper. People probably tell me good job all around town. But when I finished one book, no one ever said anything. So which one am I more likely to repeat?
Find out more information and register for the 2024 Science of Reading Star Awards Ceremony at amplify.com/Star Awards Celebrations. That's amplify.com/Star Awards Celebration, all one word.
What if a change in classroom practice could lead to change in reading outcomes? What should reading instruction include to ensure all students have the opportunity to succeed? What does cognitive science tell us about learning to read, and why aren't those learnings applied in our classrooms? Welcome to Science of Reading, the podcast. I'm your host, Susan Lambert from Amplify Education. Join us every 2 weeks as we talk with Science of Reading experts to explore what it takes to transform our classrooms and develop confident and capable readers. In today's episode, we continue our conversation about the importance of background knowledge with our guest, Robert Pondicio. Robert talks about his classroom experience and how it led him on a quest for reform. All right. Well, hello, Robert. Thank you so much for joining us today. You have been involved in so many different conversations about education and education reform, and we're here to talk about your point of view about helping students build background knowledge. But sure. What I'd really like for you to start with is, like, talk to us a little bit about how you ended up in this space. What brought you into this world?
How much time do we have? that could take all day. I had a kind of a circuitous path, I guess you could say, into education. I was a mid-career switcher. So I had a whole other life in the media world. I worked at Time Magazine and Business Week and started my career in radio news. But about, let's see, almost 20 years ago now, about 2002, I was working as the communications director for Business Week magazine in Midtown Manhattan. And I like to tell the story that I was seduced by a subway ad. Those of you who, or those of our listeners who are in New York City, may remember these ads and have heard of this organization, the New York City Teaching Fellows, which was an alternative and is an alternative certification program looking to attract mid-career professionals into hard-to-staff inner-city classrooms. So I'm riding the subway home one day, and there was this wonderful ad across the aisle from me, and it said, "You remember your first grade teacher's name, who will remember yours?" And my first thought was, "Oh, that's good." And the second thought is, "Oh, I'm curious." I'm just full disclosure, being quite candid, you know, a lot of, you hear these stories all the time about teachers who always knew they wanted to be teachers. Like when they were 6 years old, they would play school, you know, and quiz their stuffed animals and whatnot. I was not that guy. I was sort of an indifferent student. So it's kind of ironic that I ended up working in education. And full disclosure, I didn't even have my bachelor's at the time that I was seduced by that subway ad. It was a little bit short and had to finish up in order to join the program. But it was, you know, as I like to say, a mid-career impulse purchase. Signed up kind of on a lark, went through the process and then fell in love with it. I mean, as I got through I likened it to being on Survivor, you know, after various rounds, you know, they vote people off the island. And I didn't get voted off the island. And as the process went on, I thought, okay, if they're dumb enough to hire me, I'm dumb enough to do this. So I signed up to teach for 2 years in the South Bronx, and I've been and still am a longtime board member of an organization called Eastside House Settlement, which while I was on their board really kind of reinvented themselves around education. So education just kept coming up. in my not-for-profit life, across the aisle in the subway, I just had a daughter, and she was about to start school, etc. So suddenly, what began as a bit of a lark, and a I perceived or persuaded myself would be a 2-year mid-career public service stint, turned into 5 years in a South Bronx classroom, and then never going away. It just be, I think once you be more earnest about it, once you kind of start to see the issues that young children, disadvantaged children in places like the South Bronx face, you can't look away. You can't go back to what you were doing.
Yeah, the whole idea of you can't unsee it or you can't unhear it, right?
Yeah, I think that's
yeah.
right.
Yeah. Well, talk to me a little bit about your experiences then in the classroom. Well, actually, I'd like to ask you, do you remember your first grade teacher's name?
Ms. Bobowitz. I do.
There you go. There you go.
That's why it worked.
So it worked.
Beverly Hill Elementary School, not Beverly Hills, California. It was on Beverly Hill Road on Long Island where I grew up. It was Beverly Hill Elementary School. Ms. Bobowitz was my first grade teacher.
Well, then I hope your students remember your name, and I'm sure that they will. But talk to me a little bit about your classroom experiences then.
Yeah, and this will lead directly to what I think we're going to talk about, which is curriculum. So, I guess it's instructive to recapture the mindset that I had walking into this this classroom. And look, I'm a unapologetic alt-cert guy, I think. We should encourage lots of different diverse experiences and people in our classrooms. I'm maybe a little bit more casual about certification than others. Mm-hmm. But I it's not as if I was extremely well prepared for this. So the teaching fellows gave me 6 weeks of summer school and training, and then you're essentially turned loose in a classroom. As I've become fond of saying, I had not been in an elementary school since I'd been an elementary school student. So I really had very few preconceived notions about what good teaching and learning looked like, other than what I was being told in my my PD, my master's classes, et cetera. So there was, for the longest time, what I guess I would describe as a certain willing suspension of disbelief. And I should set the scene for you. This school where I taught for 5 years, PS 277 in the South Bronx, if you know New York City, it's broken up into lots of school districts. The South Bronx District 7, where I taught, was and still is, as far as I know, the lowest performing district in New York City. My school was the lowest performing school in District 7. So wow. I was literally teaching in what would be, by definition, the lowest of the low. That said, and we can talk about this as well, it was, and I tell this to all my reform friends, this was not a story of, union-addled layabouts, punching the time clock and counting the hours until retirement. The school was filled with, by and large, people trying hard and failing. And they were failing, I have argued, not despite their training, but because of it. In other words, I don't mean to pick on anybody's particularly favorite flavors of pedagogy. We did readers and writers workshop. We did everyday math, etc. The school was could be chaotic. Not surprisingly, it was a Title I very low income school in New York's most impoverished neighborhood. But where I'm going with this, Susan, is just to say, I really didn't have a mental model for what good instruction should look like. And the stuff that I was told was best practices, to be blunt, it struck me as odd. Like, I don't remember doing it this way when I was in school. A lot of reading strategies, metacognitive work, etc. And it more to the point, just didn't seem to be effective. The fifth graders that I taught, 16% of them, had passed the previous year's standardized tests. This was back when we did grade band testing, 4th, 8th, and 12th. So my 5th graders had taken the 4th grade test, and less than 1 in 5 of them were proficient in reading. And the workshop model and the skills and strategies work that we did, it just did not seem to be effective. So as I tell this story over and over again, I eventually discovered the work of a guy named E.D. Hirsch Jr., who I know you're familiar with, and perhaps many of our listeners will be as well. This was the guy who wrote Cultural Literacy in 1987. It was a surprise bestseller. We went on to found the Core Knowledge Foundation, where I worked for a time because I was so enamored of his work. Hirsch's work was the only body of work that actively described what I was seeing in my South Bronx classroom every day. Children who could decode, some more fluently than others, but they could all read, and I'm making air quotes around the word read as I say that. In other words, they were decoders, but they were not comprehenders. So Hirsch, alone among theorists, described this accurately as a lack of background knowledge, limited vocabulary and whatnot. So this is the phenomenon that we all see as teachers, where children will say, "Well, I read it, but I didn't get it." They weren't lying. And it's frustrating as a teacher, unless you see this for what it is, because you think, how could you not get it? It's right in front of you. The answers to the question are right here. But when I would bring up Hirsch's work in my PDs and grad school classes, I would almost always hear some variation, forgive me, of, "Oh, that's that dead white guy stuff. Nobody takes that seriously." I'm like, whoa, wait a minute. That's not what Hirsch's work is about at all. It's about reading comprehension, it's about background knowledge, etc. I'm telling a long, boring story, but the punchline to it is I became kind of unwittingly a rather militant about all this. It's like, wait a minute, this is the thing that our kids need the most in this school, and this is the thing we're not providing them. I mean, we're doing double literacy blocks, etc. They're not getting art or music or science or history. We're trying to teach reading as a set of disparate skills, and clearly it's not working. We should be doing this instead. So I ended up leaving my classroom after 5 years and almost literally knocking on Don Hirsch's door to say, "Look, I had this other career in the media. You're the guy who has figured this out. Let me help you get the word out." So I ended up working for the Core Knowledge Foundation for several years, and Hirsch's work to a very large degree has become my work.
That's very interesting. So given the fact that this podcast is all about the science of reading,
there you go,
and you're talking about this idea of background knowledge, can you help us make that connection then between, okay, well, what does this knowledge thing or this background knowledge thing have to do with comprehension, and what does this have to do with the science of reading and really helping develop proficient readers?
Yeah, I don't pretend to be expert on this, but I can speak from the vantage point of an ex-teacher who received none of this, and indeed when I kind of stumbled upon it, was told it's wrong. So it's that should bother us as a field, that what we know to be scientifically validated strategies for teaching children to read are not happening well enough. So I mean, and I think you've heard me natter on about this, Susan, but I think what's the important thing to realize is that, and this is not my analogy, and I don't know who to credit it to, that reading is a two-lock box. First you learn to decode, and then reading becomes really, or reading, decoding is not reading comprehension. And let me back up. I think where we go astray in all of this is, because this is certainly what happened to me as a fifth grade teacher, we teach both decoding and comprehension as skills that you can learn, practice, and master in the abstract. Now that works for decoding. I can put nonsense words in front of you and you will agree, we all will agree on how they're pronounced, even though they're made up, because there is a code to language and we learn it, practice it, and master it. But reading comprehension is not a transferable skill. It's not like, riding a bike, where if I learn to ride one bike, I can ride any bike with equal facility. Reading comprehension is what Dan Willingham, a cognitive scientist at the University of Virginia, and I'm sure others use this phrase as well, what he calls domain specific. In other words, to understand a written text about architecture, you need to know a little bit about architecture. To understand a text about baseball, you need to know a little bit about baseball. There are any number of analogies that you can use here, but one is that you have to think of a piece of text as something like an iceberg, where there's the words above the waterline, and then the vast majority of it is below the waterline, hidden from sight, so to speak. I think the best way to contextualize this, and this is another idea that Hirsch talks about a lot. Literate people, English speakers, just make assumptions about what their audience knows. So literate writers and speakers assume, you know, that we are all operating with the same base of knowledge, the same set of illusions, the same mental furniture, if you like. And when that assumption is correct, then it feels like a skill. You know, we're just having a conversation. But what Willingham and others have pointed out is that, you know, all language is really kind of a form of shorthand, in a sense, very context driven. So, I, you know, to use a simple example, think of the word shot. The word shot means something very, very different on a basketball court, on a rifle range, in a bar, or if your auto or your repairman tells you that your car is shot, or your dishwasher is shot, or some such. So, you know, what makes those words different from each other, even though they're the same word, is the context. So language is heavily dependent upon readers making correct inferences about context, and that's background knowledge. So, you know, when you know enough about baseball to know that the word sacrifice means something very different, you know, with a runner on first base in a baseball game, than it does when you're using the word, you know, about sacrificing for the sake of your children, for example, you know, the same words, different contexts. So these, and I'm using isolated examples, but my point is that language is a series of it's a nonstop exercise in inference making. That's all knowledge dependent, all content dependent. And if we're not operating from the same base of knowledge, it just breaks down.
Yeah, it seems like a rather complex problem to try to solve as it relates to, you know, the elementary classroom, because kids come to us with all kind of different background knowledge and all kind of different vocabulary, and to be able to sort of level that playing field, what might that look like? I mean, right now our classrooms are very focused on accountability measures of reading and mathematics, and I think you make the argument that's really problematic in terms of building background knowledge in a kid's overall sort of education experience.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and this takes us in a slightly different direction. So I want to be careful here, because on the one hand, I don't want anybody to get the sense that I'm anti-testing or anti-accountability.
Sure.
You know, I'm not. That said, I'm anti-dishonesty. And I think we have to, and now I'm saying not necessarily us teachers, but those of us in the education policy world, I work for an education policy think tank, we have to be honest with ourselves about the effects of these measures. So I, you know, quick war story, I give this long talk, I think you've seen me give this talk, Susan, about all of these kind of strange and mysterious ways that I was taught to teach reading comprehension to my struggling fifth grade readers in the South Bronx. And, you know, as is my wont, I make some jokes about it and we have a good laugh. And then at the end of the talk, when I'm speaking to ed policy groups, I say, okay, you know, ed reformers, so where do you see these kind of dumb and deleterious literacy practices that we just made fun of? Well, you see it in, you know, in places like my old school, and you see it in charter schools that you love so much. Oh, and who teaches this way, ed reformers? Well, you know, those 30-year, tenured union guys that you say are the problem in education teach this way, and those bright, shiny Teach for America Corps members that you love so much. So you all, speaking to an ed reform audience, either in fact or through your indifference, you're okay with this. My larger point is that those of us who work in policy have tended to be, over the years, just uninterested, bluntly, in what happens inside of classrooms. We are forever talking about things like charter schools and teacher quality and data and funding, tenure reform, et cetera. But I like to joke that I tend to be the guy in rooms like that who raises his hand and says, can we talk about what the kids are doing all day? Because that matters too. So you know, the curriculum matters, having, to your point, scientifically valid reading instruction matters. And until not just, until all of us in this work, teachers, administrators, district officials, state officials, policymakers, et cetera, until we all are a little bit more savvy about what reading is and what reading isn't, I fear we're not going to make the progress that we need to make.
It's interesting that you talk about this ed reform movement and what ed reformers are talking about and where they're paying attention and investing their energy. It hasn't so much been about the kinds of curriculum that build this background knowledge for students.
Right.
But there has been momentum around
The
issue lately. So why do you, number one, what do you see as that change? You were talking about when you went to the Core Knowledge Foundation, you wanted to highlight this issue. It seems like the issue has been highlighted. What do you see sort of the change between when you started here and kind of where we're at now?
It's a great question. And I, on the one hand, I don't want to be pessimistic, but neither do I want to be overly credulous. We've had false dawns before, so to speak. In other words, I say this all the time. I haven't had an idea about education that E.D. Hirsch Jr. didn't have first and more comprehensively. So he's been talking about this stuff for going on 40 years now. And he gets discovered and rediscovered, periodically. Then folks like me come along who, flap their jowls and get attention for it. And there's a new book out by a woman named Natalie Wexler called The Knowledge Gap that a lot of people are picking up and reading and saying, wow, this is exactly right. And on the one hand, I'm like, this is a great book. I'm glad Natalie wrote it. On the other hand, I'm thinking, well, we've been talking about this for 40 years. Come on, let's go. My rueful joke here is that Winston Churchill supposedly said once that the Americans can always be counted upon to do the right thing after having exhausted all other options. So there's a little bit of that perhaps going on because, let's be candid, those of us in the ed reform world, if we are willing to be honest with ourselves, have to admit that we have basically run American education for the last generation or so, imposing a standards-based vision of education and accountability and testing and whatnot. And I'm not against those things, but again, I think it's important to be clear-eyed about the instructional practices that those things incentivize. But the larger point is it's underperformed. It really has not had the effect that I think the architects of standards-based reform and testing and accountability expected them to have, back in the days of, A Nation at Risk and No Child Left Behind. So I think we have to be honest and say, wait, why isn't this working as well as we thought it would? And this is confirmation bias on my part, but I assume, believe the answer is because we have been inattentive to classroom practice. We've been inattentive to curriculum. We have not been learning the lessons that Don Hirsch and others have been trying to teach us for 40 years.
Yeah. I'm going to pull this all the way down to something, super specific and get this sort of out of this policy world and into the classroom. I'm looking at an article you wrote for Knowledge Matters Campaign. We can talk about that in a minute, but you co-authored with Lisa Hansel.
Yep.
And one of the takeaways you have from this article, and by the way, we'll link our listeners in show notes to this, is you say this: the only way to close the reading achievement gap is to provide a well-rounded education starting on the very first day of school when the academic knowledge and vocabulary gaps are the smallest.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, look, I think this is where you have to be clear-eyed because, and as is my wont, I'm going to paint with a bit of a broad brush here, but hopefully be, responsible in my oversimplification. One of the ideas behind, the last generation or so of education reform is that poverty should not be determinative. What is the phrase we say? That demographics is not destiny. That we agree. But having said that, you have to also acknowledge and address that children do, to your very good point, Susan, come to us at age 4 with in different places along their language trajectories. Some kids are blessed with two parents with college degrees who speak in full sentences and engage their children in rich dinner table conversation. Their evenings are filled with books read aloud to them. Their summers are filled with enrichment, museum travel, ballet lessons, what have you. They are absorbing from the very first moments of life. They are kind of growing up in a rich verbal stew and a knowledge rich stew and an experience rich stew. The children that I taught, teach, and so many like them don't have those advantages. That does there's a real cost associated with that when children do not come to school on the first days. on their first days with you know, a rich working vocabulary and those mental models for various things that they're going to read about. So those are real disadvantages. But the point is exactly as we said in that piece, that the gap is only going to get larger. Because we all start basically from the same starting line in the delivery room, and then we go on our different ways from there. So the gap is smallest at age four, and it could only get larger. So you know, this is why I've said for years that the battle is won and lost in early childhood. We need to kind of come correct, as it were, on this, and understand language development for what it is, you know, not for what we wish it would be. And if you see this clearly enough, then suddenly, you know, the lessons of a Don Hirsch become that much more urgent. It's like, oh my goodness, I really have to break rocks from the very first day of school to get my kids, my students, exposed to as much history, science, art, music, you know, the full, you know, panoply of knowledge that literate people take for granted, because I've only got so much time. I've got, you know, 180 days times 12 years, and I got to get busy. So this is not to say that we shouldn't be concerned with student engagement, that we shouldn't be concerned with issues of culturally relevant pedagogy and whatnot. But once you see the language gap for what it is, principally a knowledge gap, you immediately have some very hard decisions to make. What do my kids need to know? More pertinently, what will the world assume they know? Because that's what language is.
Yeah, and it's all like, as a former classroom teacher myself, I think about this issue and I think, For one particular teacher in one particular classroom over the course of one particular year, it feels like unsolvable at the classroom level.
Oh, it is, because it is unsolvable, Susan. Now we're going to get really down in the weeds. How do we fix this? By acknowledging what you just said. This is too big for any one teacher to solve on his own or her own. Now, on the one hand, I don't want to be dour. There's no such thing as wasted knowledge. You know, in talking about this, I often use the analogy of the window and the mirror. Everything that I was taught in my, you know, poor performing public school in the South Bronx suggested that the reason low-income kids of color, my students, were not reading at the level that affluent, you know, white children were reading two subway stops away on the Upper East Side had to do with issues of engagement and metacognition. In other words, what we need to do is hook them on reading, turn them into lifelong lovers of the printed word. Let them see themselves in the books that they read, let them be engaged, and then the magic of comprehension will occur. Well, it just doesn't work that way. So I counsel teachers, less mirror, more window. In other words, that you need to focus a child's attention outside the classroom, not inside his or her head. And I don't want to overstate that. I mean, because obviously, you know, we want children to be engaged, and this is not a dull and dry march through content for 13 years. You know, but this is should be exciting stuff for kids. But the orientation, I think, is important. You know, we should, wherever possible, from the earliest days of school, we should be attempting to focus children's attention out the window, not in the mirror.
Yeah.
Or just at least let's bring that back into balance. I'm sensitive. I don't want to give the idea that it's binary. But right now it's all mirror, very little window.
Yeah. That makes sense. And so I, you know, again, as a classroom teacher, I think that just understanding how important it is to open up worlds to kids that they may not experience other ways and understand the connection of that back to reading comprehension.
Yeah, I think that's right.
It seems a little elusive. It seems like, well, this doesn't make a whole lot of sense. I know as a third grade classroom teacher, like I didn't have to worry about teaching phonics anymore. And there was a sort of shift from teaching the kids, you know, how to read to now we're going to read to learn. But I think what we're saying is we want to introduce that concept earlier in their schooling experience.
Well, let me be a little bit more granular about it. I should have said this in answer to your previous question. If you have the idea, and what I would argue is the demonstrably false idea, that reading comprehension is a skill, and that engagement is all that matters, that if, you know, if kids love to read, they will read more and they will become good readers just by practicing it the way you would throwing a ball or riding a bike. Well, that will lead you to make certain decisions. You will say, well, the most important thing is eyes on the page. So it's the most important thing is to get in children's hands books that they love, because therefore they will spend more time reading. They will become better readers. You know, there's a surface plausibility to that. There's nothing wrong with more reading. I mean, for very good reasons. Even Keith Stanovich, another cognitive scientist based at the University of Toronto, did a paper some years ago and pointed out that the language of even children's books is quite sophisticated, and that there are more rare and unique words per thousand than just about anything else you're going to read. For kids, in other words, reading does build vocabulary, does build knowledge, etc. So it's not a bad impulse. It's just an incomplete one. Once you see, but understand that idea where it leads. So if you say, look, my job as a teacher is just to get kids engaged and keep them reading, well, then my lesson planning becomes, what can I teach kids that will engage them and inspire them to read more? I know I'm going to teach the rainforest, because I am just picking this example at random, because, you know, I'm interested in the rainforest. It's got animals. The kids will love it, and we'll read about the rainforest. Well, then you end up, what if the fourth grade teacher also teaches the rainforest, and the fifth grade teacher? Then you end up with an education where kids get the rainforest three times, and the Bill of Rights never, and China never, and a thousand other topics never. So the point you made earlier about this is too much of a problem for a third grade teacher to solve by himself or herself is exactly right. The grain size, at the very least, has to be the school, probably the district. It can't be the nation, for reasons that we can discuss later. You know, in the United States, education is under state control, so there's never going to be a national curriculum the way they have in other countries. That's a non-starter. But it has to be coordinated. Otherwise, you will end up inevitably with these gaps in repetitions, with these kind of false ideas about knowledge building or lack of urgency around it. And then we will wonder why kids continue to read it and not get it, because we did not close that knowledge gap, because we did not give them this, again, the same array of mental furniture that literate people assume they have.
Yeah. It's amazing to me that we assume we send our kids to school to learn things, and things aren't being taught.
Can I just interject there, Susan? Because one thing is I've been talking about this for a very long time. I've given like hundreds of talks about background knowledge and literacy. And almost invariably, when you talk to a parent about this, as opposed to a teacher, the very first thing they say is, oh, I thought all schools do that. You know, in other words, we send our kids off to elementary school, and we assume that this is exactly what schools do, that they give kids history and science and art and music and the full range of interesting subjects that we all know and love. Well, they don't. You know, your child's reading is probably dominated by skills and strategies.
Yeah. So what, for our listeners, if they have become interested in this topic of background knowledge and its relationship to reading comprehension, what kind of resources would you suggest to them that they can explore more?
Well, I invoked this new book by Natalie Wexler, The Knowledge Gap. It was just published within the last couple of weeks or months. It's a pretty good under one cover guide to this. Don Hirsch is well into his 90s now, still vital, still writing about this. He's brought out any number of books. The most famous one is Cultural Literacy. My personal favorite in his canon is a book called The Knowledge Deficit. The best 10 minutes that you can spend to get an introduction to how this works at the kind of level of language, go on YouTube and Google Teaching Content is Teaching Reading, which is the title of a 10-minute video, Teaching Content is Teaching Reading, by Dan Willingham of the University of Virginia, whose name I've invoked once or twice while we're speaking. It's a real, I wish, whenever I talk to teachers about this, you know, I say if I had a magic wand, I would make sure that every teacher in America sees this video as part of his or her training, at least every elementary school teacher, because it describes in 10 minutes exactly the role that background knowledge plays in making language comprehension happen.
Great. Well, we can also put that link in our show notes so listeners can find that pretty quickly.
Super.
Let's make a little bit of a transition here.
Sure.
You pushed somebody else's book, so let's talk about your new book, even though it's not primarily about background knowledge or curriculum. Oh. You've written this new book called How the Other Half Learns. Tell us a little bit about that.
Oh, thanks for that. Thanks for the question. It's not about this. I do talk, because this is what I do, in that book about what the kids are doing all day. In fact, that's the conceit of the book. It's about Success Academy, which is this rather controversial network of charter schools in New York City, which for the last decade or so has been producing these otherworldly results on standardized tests. And even when we all went to Common Core and everybody fell out of bed, their scores got better. And every year these scores come out. And some years ago, I wrote a piece about Success Academy for the New York Daily News. And I remember saying, I have no idea if Eva Moskowitz is the Michael Jordan of standardized testing or the Mark McGuire. And for sports fans, or for non-sports fans, that's comparing a gifted natural athlete, Michael Jordan, the basketball player, with a guy who was caught cheating with using steroids in baseball. I remember writing in this piece, somebody needs to go up to Harlem and figure out what the hell is happening. And it turns out that guy was me. So I spent a year at Success Academy at one of their schools, literally across the street from where I was a student teacher in the New York City teaching fellows, and just down the block from, or a few blocks away from where I was teaching fifth grade. So same family, same conditions, same demographics, same everything, very, very different results. It's a charter school, so there's that. So there is a certain element of parental self-selection that looms large in the story. But I did spend, obviously, quite a lot of time. I spent hundreds of hours at this one school observing instruction. And one thing, to bring it back to the main conversation, while it is not, Success Academy is not a core knowledge school, I think I even said this in the book, Don Hirsch would probably feel quite comfortable there, because, and even though they're doing a lot of parts of, say, Readers and Writers Workshop that may not be my preferred flavor of pedagogy, they are all about the window, and they're not about the mirror. So the kids are getting science every day, art and music and dance and chess and whatnot. They're forever going out on what they call field studies, what you and I would call field trips, exploring the city for what they call project-based learning, and what I would actually argue is more like cross-curricular units. There's some aspects about the teaching there that work as well. Even though they make curriculum decisions that might not be the ones that I would make, and I think this is the biggest takeaway for what can the rest of us learn about Success Academy, they have a curriculum. So the job of teaching at these schools is very different than my job was, and I suspect the job of a lot of teachers is. They spend not 1 minute as instructional designers, and they spend all their time as instructional deliverers. This is a completely different subject, Susan, but I'm fascinated and alarmed, frankly, by the data that came from a recent RAND study that showed that, I think from memory, the figure was 98% of teachers, literally just about every teacher in America, spends time looking for materials or using their own materials or looking for materials. I mean, an ungodly amount of time is spent not focused on student work, not building relationships with kids, not giving feedback, etc., but simply staring at an empty plan book and saying, what am I going to teach tomorrow? And to bring this full circle, that makes sense if you have a skills-driven vision of education, that my job is to figure out what's going to engage the kids and teach them the skill of compare and contrast and find the main idea, etc., etc.
Right.
But at Success Academy, they happily do not buy into those ideas. But more pertinently, they have a curriculum. So the job of the teacher there is that list I mentioned before. It's studying student work. It's looking for patterns of error. It's practicing the lessons. It's building relationships with kids and families, etc. And as a result, they get phenomenally good results from relatively inexperienced teachers, which is fascinating.
Yeah, thanks for that. It's great. I'm sure many of our listeners are going to want to start following what you're doing and what you're up to in this world as a result of this conversation. I do appreciate you joining us. And as we sort of bring this thing to the closing, what is the one thing as it relates to this idea of building background knowledge? What's the one thing that you really want people to take away about this or get excited or interested about as it relates to student achievement?
Yeah, I think I dropped a mention of the Dan Willingham video, teaching content is teaching reading. Those words, that teaching content is teaching reading, is probably the thing that we all need to understand and then follow that idea where it leads. In other words, I guess my wish, Susan, would be that teachers, and particularly elementary teachers and early elementary school teachers, would understand, as I like to say, that reading comprehension is not a skill that you teach, it's a condition you create. And what I mean by that is what we've been speaking about for the last 45 minutes, that you have to attend to background knowledge, you have to attend to the mental furniture, as I like to say, that children carry around with them, because that's where the magic of language proficiency and comprehension happens, not through trying to teach and practice metacognitive reading skills. I mean, there's some advantage to skills and strategies. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying don't do it, but a little goes a long way. And that if we really want to raise, and we do, good readers, the way to do that is by understanding reading comprehension for what it is, not what we wish it was.
Yeah, thanks so much, Robert. Again, for our listeners, we will link you in our show notes to all the resources that Robert was talking about. And thanks again, Robert. We appreciate it. We're so grateful to our amazing guest today and to all of you making a difference in the lives of students every single day. Be sure to check the show notes for resource links from today's podcast, and we want to hear your stories and successes. Follow us on Facebook at Science of Reading, the community, or send an email to sormatters@amplify.com. Tell us what guests you think we should book, or tell us about the research that really excites you. And be sure to hit the subscribe button on your favorite podcast app so you don't miss an episode. Until next time, I'm Susan Lambert from Amplify Education.